Pietism, then, which I talked about last time, had its sources and inspiration separate and not merely as a reaction to the Enlightenment. Indeed, we must be clear chronologically, which is important, that Pietism grew up at roughly the same time as the Enlightenment, roughly 1660 to 1760. I talked last time about popular piety as the source and continued inspiration for Pietism, about the depths of the mystical tradition, especially in Germany, much less so in England, about the difference which comes about between Pietism in Germany and Evangelism in England because of the depth of mystical ideas in Germany. A difference that is reflected in your reading between Zinzendorf on the one hand and Tom Brown's School Day on the other. One German Pietism, the other English Evangelism. But Pietism and Evangelism have a common root, in Pietism, in Lutheranism in many ways. They share the centrality of conversion, the inner reform, the coming to Christ, the things that you will read about in your Zinzendorf reading, a personalized religion in a growingly impersonal world. They share also the idea of sinfulness, the idea of insight into your own sins as the start of Reformation, as the necessary prerequisite of conversion. And this insight into your own sin meant a modification of the idea of elect. Anyone who has insight in his own sinfulness has the possibility of conversion. And this became a very central and important tenet for the disciplining of Pietism and Evangelism. And as I said at the end of last time, I will read you a rather famous passage about that from the most famous children's book in England at the beginning of the 19th century. The children's book is called The Fairchild Family of 1818. The Fairchild Family, which is what would be for us a rather cruel story of crime and punishment. The little girls fight at the age of 6, and they are led out to sit all night below a gallows where a criminal has been hanged in order to show them what becomes of little girls who start fighting among each other. Every chapter with a moral precept ends in a prayer, but the centerpiece is the diary of Lucy Fairchild, called Lucy Fairchild's Journal, written when she was 9 years and a half old. "When I awoke this morning, Mama called to me to make my bed and dust the room, and I felt cross and wished I was like Miss Augusta Noble, who comes to an evil end. She does not listen, she doesn't know her sinfulness, plays with matches and is burned. And I wish I was like Miss Augusta Noble and had servants to wait upon me and was proud and wished for fine things. And that Lady Noble was my mama, and not my own dear mama. Mama gave Emily, the sister, a bit of muslin and some pink ribbon, and I was envious. When Papa gave Henry a strawberry, I was angry again. And then I thought a very bad thought indeed. When Mrs. Barker came, I despised her for being ugly, though I knew that God had made her such as she is, and that he could make me as ugly in one moment." As soon as Lucy had finished writing these last words, she heard her mama come up the stairs and go into her room, and she immediately ran to her and, showing the book, said, "Oh, mama, mama," she said, "you cannot think what a wicked heart I have got. Here is my journal. I am ashamed to show it to you. Pray do not hate me for what is written in this book." Mrs. Fairchild took the book, and when she had read what has written, "My dear child," she said, "I thank God, who has by his Holy Spirit helped you to know a little of the wickedness of your heart. Your heart, my dear, is no worse and no better than the hearts of all human creatures, for there is no good, not one. Proverbs 29:19. And yet, as I told you before, there are many people who live to a very old age without knowing that their hearts are wicked. They think themselves good, though they are evil. But happy are those, my dear Lucy, who are brought to the knowledge of their own sinful nature while they are young. More than I can say for you with 9 1/2. What were you doing with 9 1/2? I can imagine. So, anyway, this is the essence of it. And you find it already in the English Puritans, of course, the keeping of a diary of your sin, a daily diary, as Lucy Fairchild does, in order to realize your sinfulness, in order what Freud will call to have an insight into your sinfulness. Now, this kind of diary is a method of control. For the great difficulty in pietism, in what you read, is that it can get out of hand. I cited to you last time Cromwell's dialogue with the Ranter in the English Revolution, where the Ranter tells Cromwell, that's a sect, tells Cromwell, well, you know, you can say whatever you like, General, but if God gives me an inspiration, I'll do what God tells me to do. And Cromwell says, well, that's not a basis on which you can rule England. That's not a basis on which you can rule anything. So the problem in this kind of enthusiasm, as we might call it, yes, in this kind of personalized religion, is the problem, obviously, of discipline. And the problem of discipline goes back here to a moral rigor, to a new kind of morality. A new kind of morality which will be the beginning of our modern manners and morals. As you can see already what I read you from the Fairchild family, but I shall come back to that. The beginning of our shame of the body, the beginning of our modern clothes, of our modern morality, of our modern sexual shame, going back to the original idea of Sodom in the Bible, that that sex is only for procreation, and any other sex is indeed sinful, comes back to Sodom spilling his seed on the ground. God killed him for that. So all of the other things that you have here, obviously, are a moral rigorism which comes into play. But here also you have the evangelical idea in England via pietism. The moral rigorism in England will lead, in a way, to a stress on outward signs, to the performance of public duty. It is the beginning of this, I think, very wonderful thing, which the Anglo-Saxons have so much more than any other people, and whose absence you notice in many countries I could mention. The absence of the public spirit, the absence of voluntarism, the public spirit, the absence of what Kingsley called sanitary work as a public duty. That is, this activism of evangelism. But in German, pietism, it became an idea of obedience to authority because of Luther's basis on Romans 13, obey the powers that be, for they are of God. Romans chapter 13, obey the powers that be, they are of God. You get in German pietism this idea of obedience to authority. This idea of political indifferentism, that it doesn't matter what the government is. This famous Lutheran hymn, what does it matter if I am behind bars, as long as my spirit is free, one of the most famous hymns of Luther, but which typifies this idea of political indifferentism, which was to be so fateful in Germany, so fateful. But out of which came so many of the German philosophers, including Hegel and others, who were not necessarily politically indifferent, but who always had this idea of worldly governments are really indifferent. What matters is your own soul, your own inner discipline. In England, this got translated in John Wesley and later in Methodism. It got, in eventually evangelism, it got translated to external actions, to public actions, to sanity work as a religious duty, to the spirit of public service, to ruling the empire, and eventually to Tom Brown's idea of being educated to be a Christian gentleman. There is no concept of a Christian gentleman in Germany. There's only a concept of a Christian gentleman in England, because a Christian gentleman is Tom Brown, educated for ruling, educated for setting an example, educated in a sense for conversion, something that drops away in Lutheranism in many ways. So educated for conversion, to bring the manners and morals and the spirit of service to the empire, to England. Another way of controlling pietism, I will now illustrate concretely in Germany, where we must now remain. For I must now come to Count Zinzendorf, whose 9 lectures you are after all reading. A central personality apart from Spener and the others. But Zinzendorf would have shared with Spener and Franke this kind of moral rigorism. I want to read you, and I forgot to do that, something, in fact, from the famous work by Spener, which I quoted you last time, The Desired Piety, Pia Desiderata, which is very typical for this sort of thing. When it comes to meals, so be moderate in eating and drinking. And when in eating and drinking you do too much, think that this is a temptation to sin against God. Do not be tempted to fill your stomach. Through much eating, body and soul are made heavy. Everywhere and at all times, be careful before indecent gesture with your hands, indecent positions of the body. Indecency, indecent gestures with your hands, indecent position of the body exemplifies disorder of spirit, betrays a secret disorder. Here you see the outward decency and the inward decency. Again, a matter of controlling this enthusiasm, fusing it with a certain moral rigor, which of course the Puritans and Calvin had as well, to the matter of decency, we shall come back. Be careful, said Spener, of unnecessary laughter. All laughter is not forbidden. It happens that even the most pious laugh, but not about worldly, but only about spiritual matters, a spiritual joy. And then his mouth merely has a gesture of modest laughter. Always, and I'll come back to that, because that will be the essence of our modern manner and morals. Always moderation. That's again where it coincides with middle-class ambitions. That where it coincides, in a way, with the kind of middle-class behavior which did make money, which did make you go ahead in that early phase of capitalist development. And always in contrast to court society, in contrast to the Enlightenment, in contrast to Voltaire, who had a mistress, as everybody in that society did, in contrast to court society, you have this kind of rigorism as an outward sign of inward grace. And then it is generalized, this. Don't think you are better than anywhere else. Don't think you are better, because in the last resort, all men are dust and ashes. Or to go to another quick example to make it clear to you, Spener's advice to 12 students who were traveling in the Baltic of 722, who said, how should we behave on our travels? And Spener tells them, as you travel, of course, do not quarrel. Do not quarrel. And no unnecessary curiosity. Only notice useful things. And here you have this whole trend that if you have an outward world, it must be a useful world. And that, of course, will in evangelism go into the idea of public service, which will be so important, into the idea of serving the public, of voluntarism, the good ladies, the women's clubs, the I don't know what. It's very much with us. No unnecessary curiosity. No dangerous and idle conversation. Because idle conversation and idleness in general can lead to sin. And here, of course, is the center, John Wesley's work, pray, and save. No idleness. Idle hands are bad. No idleness. Do you know why? Finally, with your mouth, tell the truth, only the truth. That is the force, that is the life, that is the teaching of Jesus Christ. Now, these ideas, Zinzendorf tried to realize, and he realized them typically enough in a German way by founding in 1723 what he called the Covenant of the Brethren. Those who were convinced pietists made a covenant together, a very Puritan things to do. Under the influence of Franke, they came from Halle, the German city of Halle, the center of this pietism, the famous University of Halle, founded really by Franke, the University of Halle, a pietistic foundation. They founded a community which they called the head, the hat of the Lord, Herrenhut, the hat of the Lord. And that community was to be extremely important. For it is in this community that John Wesley had his awakening. But not only that, it is that community that some of you know, because it came to America. It came to America both in the Amana colonies in Iowa, from Ronneborg, which was a kind of other Herrenhut settlement, and above all it came in the town of Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, which was founded directly from Herrenhut as another community of the pious in a world of the impious. In England that was impossible. The evangelicals, John Wesley, in reaction, worked in the world and with the world. But in Germany, typically enough, it was a kind of withdrawal into these islands, in Herrenhut, the community of the brethren, a brethren community. That community was based upon the charismatic leadership ideas of the New Testament. Officers were chosen by lot, God's declaration of his will, you understand. Zinzendorf, of course, was the real leader. But the people underneath it were divided into choirs. Single men and single women lived in separate community houses, and the children were also grouped in separate houses. They were all grouped in separate houses. Youth was the property of the community. And single brethren and single sisters pledged themselves to be marriage secondary to the work of the church. And the work of the church was the work of prayer. There was hourly prayer. But the main emphasis was not only on the hourly prayer. You see, sex is only for procreation. Once in Herrenhut you had fulfilled your procreative function, women and men were separate, and children were separate as well. And their function was prayer and conversion, prayer and individual conversion. But the center was really the hymn, the Singstunde, the famous singing hour, the Singstunde, still, I shall come back to it from another point much later, the Singstunde lay music. For you have an important step here in the transition of music from church music to lay music. For the inhabitants of Herrenhut were laymen. They took no religious orders. Zinzendorf was a count with large estates. He was not in a religious orders. Pietism was a lay movement. The hymn, which had always been a lay affair, but sung in church, now definitely left the church, and you get a very important movement towards lay movement, towards lay singing, which will become a passion. All over Germany, so-called Liedertafeln, that is to say, lay singing clubs, sprang up, and laymen practiced singing in choir. It's the beginning of the modern choir movement, but it is really the beginning of lay singing, of what you would call community singing. And the first community songs were, in this sense, structured community singing. In popular piety, that's always been the case. Structure. The hymn. The hymn, after all, let us remember that when Protestantism was fossilized, when Lutheranism became the Book of Confession of 1588, where even Luther's printing mistakes were elevated to dogma, the hymn had always escaped books of confessions. The hymns always escaped fossilized religion. Gerhard's hymns, after all the 30 Years' Wars, these hymns of the cross and consolation had been for most people the real spiritual and inward religion. So that was quite natural that the Herrenhut took up hymn singing as the central. And such an enthusiasm, such a need for a spiritual religion. For hymn singing are two things at once. Remember that. Hymn singing is an inward spiritual renewal, but it is also a community experience, a disciplining experience. Yes? It's not individual chaos, so easy in pietism, so easy in coming to Christ, so much a part of the John Wesley's campfire meetings. You know all this. Modern evangelism is a continuation for that. This is an individual experience, but there's always a longing for a group experience. And no religion, no thought lasts unless it is institutionalized. And the importance of Herrenhut is that it is part of the institutionalizing, not through the brethren communities. They will be of no great importance. They will continue to exist here in the Amana colonies, in America, here and there. But they will be of no very great importance. But what will be of very great importance is that pietism became a community experience. And here, of course, these communities are of an importance. And that this community experience was, for most people, not really exemplified by the sermon or the Bible reading, as much as by the hymn. And so you get, of course, the beginning of the great musical age in Germany. Didn't come from nowhere. The great musical age in Germany, the great romantic German music, has a root in this development towards lay music that I have just talked about. This pietism at Herrenhut, then, was one institutionalization. It was, as you will see in your Zinzendorf reading, what it was. And it was also, typically enough, a kind of withdrawal. In your Zinzendorf reading, I want you to pay some attention to what he says about how you act in this world, what the consequence for your political action should be. This is in your reading. You should pay some attention to it. But in the last resort, what you have here, therefore, is a discipline through these choirs, through this community, through the community which Wesley was to repudiate. In 1740, Wesley withdrew from the brethren. He withdrew from the brethren, not just because of this, because of some theological differences to which I will come, but also because he was centered towards working in this world. His revival meetings contrast to Herrnhut. Herrnhut is prayer, hymn singing, indifference to authority. Really. Wesley will be, after all, as you know, campfire meetings, revival meetings, missionary, aggressiveness, after all, is involved. Not to be sure, revolt against authority. Wesley was never tired to remind people of Romans 13, obey the powers that be. He asked the Indian slaves in the West Indies to be obedient to their masters, for example. Not that, though he had a real sympathy for the downtrodden. It's only later, with John Wilberforce, as you will see, that this becomes the abolition of slavery. But in John Wesley, there is already built in what will lead to the abolition of slavery, which will lead to give the pietism definite political consequences. And one will be the abolition of slavery. That will be one consequence. So you see the difference here already. It is a difference of approach, in a way. And it is a difference in theology, inasmuch as Wesley was afraid that this little community would lead to the Pelagian heresy, to a heresy of sinless perfection, which I told you last time, that those who elect might think they can do anything they like. So he was afraid of that in Herrnhut. This is true, but much more than that, it was a difference between the English and the German background, between the tradition of Eckhart and Tauler. After all, Luther had edited at the beginning a work of German mysticism, the so-called German theology, which Luther edited. So it is a difference between a Lutheran background and, after all, John Wesley's Anglican background, which knew really no such mystical tradition, which really knew such mystical tradition, whose inward revivals were always more outwardly centered, if you like. His inward revival were always more outwardly centered. What you have, therefore, here is two things that I would like to stress. First of all, you have in Herrnhut another way of exemplifying the attempt to discipline pietism into a community. For Zinzendorf, the community was the community elect. For John Wesley and the evangelist, the community will be England. It won't just be the elect, it will be England. It will be the empire. There's a great difference to that. There's a great difference in approach. Yes? And you don't work out. That difference, secondly, in Zinzendorf you can also see the importance of the hymn as a community experience. And thirdly, you must put it together with the other discipline, the discipline through manners and morals. The discipline through what we might call, just in shorthand at this moment, a moral rigorism. The discipline of a kind of moral rigorism, which I have read you in Spener, and which we come back to in the foundation of our manners and morals. But that's a community experience. I know that you look upon this as conformity, though this new kind of morality is so ingrained to you, that as I look at you out here from a 18th century point of view, you all look alike. You all dress alike. You all have now the alike haircuts, except him. Alike haircuts, and some like me who have none. But the others all have the alike haircuts. You all look alike. You all are clones. From a 18th century, you're all clones. Your love for quiet colors, for example. But all of this conformity was in pietism another way of experience community. All this idea was to feel yourself as one of the elect. Now, I'm sure you don't dress the way you do because you keep a diary like Lucy Fairchild, and you have realized that this morning you were envious, and this morning you were jealous, and God knows what you did last night. And you didn't keep it on a diary, so that you are today dressing this way in order to show that you have realized your sin and that you will better yourself. You're not doing that. It's become so deep a conformity, in a sense, which is an interesting problem we shall come back to. But I'm making this because what you take as natural was another kind of experience of community, another way of taming this individualism. For there is in history a kind of rhythm, if you like. There are many rhythms in history. But one rhythm in history is the quest towards individualism and at the same time the quest of community. That's what all of us want. We want to be individuals, but we also want to have a community. And through that you get these double movements, these dialectics, which you'll have again in Hegel and many others, of individualism and community. And in pietism, this is done through a moral rigorism, together with an emotional community experience, the hymn. But that's up to be an isolated experience, yes? That you can't really, how are you going to do that to the empire, ruling the empire? You can't rule the British Empire with hymns. You can rule it through Tom Browns, but not with hymns. So that, on the other hand, in the end, you have, of course, this kind of taming. You have this too, then, in John Wesley. But the difference is, of course, important in two ways. The pietism was a movement politically which was to influence the environment from which Hegel, Schelling, as I told you, most German writers and poets of the 19th century came, the parish house. They were all sons and daughters, sons of ministers, Lutheran ministers. Well, they were more literate than others. They were more up to write. They were more up to go to the university. But they were all to a man. You can think of anybody. It's a historical phenomena. And almost to a man, they went to a famous pietistic institution, which I can't talk about, the Stift in Tübingen, where Hegel went, where Herder went, where everybody went. Tübingen was another pietist university. And there was in there a kind of Herrenhut in miniature. The so-called Stift in Tübingen still exists today. The Stift in Tübingen, to which Herder and Hegel and everybody went, where you practiced the kind of prayer and contemplation and even hymn singing and piety while you went to university. So you went to Tübingen, all that sort of thing. As a result, you get German idealism and German literature becoming strangely provincial in many ways. Strangely provincial German literature. Withdrawn. Unpolitical, if I can use that. It's because it's highly political. It's the most political thing you can imagine. But acceptance of authority, acceptance of the state, withdrawal into inwardness, which is the essence, after all, of German idealism. But in England, Methodism is totally different. It is Methodism that teaches the workers to organize. It is Methodism which will be, as E.P. Thompson has shown in a very famous book, The Making of the English Working Class, it is Methodism which at the end of the 18th century will capture the imagination of the artisan class, the skilled worker class, and they will gather to read the Bible, and more than to read the Bible, to pray together, but also to better their lot. In other words, again, this outreach that you have here, as we'll see today. This is summarized very well by a leading Methodist, Robert Southey, in 1820, when he writes, "Perhaps the manner in which Methodism has familiarized the lower classes to the work of combining in associations." You see, Zinzendorf, Herrenhut combined in associations. But in Germany, that had no consequence. No consequence. Because in a way, this mystical and Roman 13 tradition was so strong. But in England, the combining and association had a consequence, very important. Making rules for their own governance, raising funds, may be reckoned among the incidental benefits that have sprung. E.P. Thompson puts a great deal emphasis as this as the beginning, the fulfilling of the longing of communitarianism and association within the early English working classes. Now, finally, this was not John Wesley's intention, but the outcome is interesting. It shows the growing difference between England and Germany, and when you say Germany, in many ways you say Central Europe. Between England and Central Europe, the Anglo-Saxon spirit and the Central European spirit, which knows no voluntary work. The Americans tried to introduce it to Germany after the Second World War, that you have to volunteer for public work and public duty and public involvement. That's an unknown tradition. It's now existing in the so-called citizens' initiatives in Germany. It's now big. But for a long time, even after the Second World War, it is not in the German tradition, but it is very much, as you know, in the Anglo-Saxon tradition. It is a very important part of it. But it isn't a consequence. And I would put it this way, the difference between the parish house in Germany and rugby in England, the school of Tom Brown, says it all. That says it all. That says the difference between England and Germany, between the United States and Central Europe, between what we call, without making a racist thing of it, the Anglo-Saxon spirit and the Central European spirit, in a way. Finally, of course, we must come back to the morality. That morality was, of course, enforced eventually by what you might call irreligious terrorism. It has been said that of rugby, Tom Brown schooled, that it was a sexual concentration camp. I think there's a great deal of truth to it. Rugby was a kind of sexual concentration camp. Officially, unofficially, things went on that would make your hair stand on edge. I must reminisce on this, that my parents, typically of that generation, sent me to a rabbi to be cleared up about sexual matters after I had been in a boarding school for 2 years. And he told my parents that your child is lost.
Lost?
Ein verworfenes Kind in German. Yes? So, I mean, what really went on at rugby is quite different than what you read about, of course. You read about the idealization of all of this kind of stuff. That is clear, but there was this kind of morality. And that morality was shared again by evangelism and by pietism. It was shared. Now, from saying that, we are now going to follow two trends separately. We have arrived about at the year 1800, and we must follow two trends which come out of pietism, and in which pietism was most important, and we shall follow them separately, one after another. First, we must see, I think, the rise of modern manners and morals, and we shall start that Friday. And secondly, we must see the transition to the Romantic movement. For it is clear that in Germany and England, pietism charged the atmosphere with emotion, released into the atmosphere a vast amount of emotionalism, popularized again books of private devotion, popularized emotional tracts about religion, popularized, as it were, an emotional view of looking at the world, which becomes, I think, in the transition from the Enlightenment to Romanticism, something of the greatest importance, something of the greatest importance, and something that we must not lose sight of, together with the other factors Perhaps that is the cardinal factor. And though, as you will see in Werther, which is your next reading, in the Werther reading, that there is no religion in it, there is in Werther, nevertheless, I think, a quest for personalization on a different level than the Enlightenment abstractions. There is in Werther, again, not the personalization of God, but the personalization, if you like, of God's nature. There is in Werther the same quest of freedom from sin. But the symbol of this is not Christ, it is Charlotte. It is Charlotte, his sweetheart, who typifies innocence and freedom from sin and virtue, as every woman will be from now on. The great metaphor for woman now, first applied to Queen Louisa of Prussia, the metaphor for woman now is a woman out of whose womb a rose grows. You will find that full in German poetry, in Kleist, in von Brentano, in many of the German poets of the beginning of the 19th century. That will be the metaphor of woman, a woman out of whose womb a rose grows, the rose a symbol both of the Virgin Mary and of innocence and virginity. So the woman is directly now tied to this innocent and virginity, as is Charlotte. Charlotte had a tremendous impact on the history of women. She and Rebecca there in Ivanhoe, of course, are the two women models for the next two centuries. A woman was either Rebecca or she was Charlotte. You could take your choice, but they have a lot in common. And certainly this idea of innocence, of a rose, of the equivalent to the Virgin Mary, all of this is in Romanticism. So though you may think Werther is very free of religion, still Werther typifies, if you like, a kind of pietism, a kind of pietistic impulse, a kind of pietistic impulse, secularized, in a sense, in the quest for personalization, the quest for the overcoming of sin, the quest for innocence. For in Romanticism, of course, both woman and nature are the metaphor for innocence. Both woman and nature are the metaphor for innocence in Romanticism. And there is, therefore, a great parallel which you see here. But more immediately out of pietism comes, of course, this rigorism in manners and morals. This rigorism in manners and morals, which was a way of disciplining it. Now, when you read Werther again, ask yourself, can this be disciplined? And the answer in Werther is, of course, no. Werther by Goethe is a story of undisciplined emotionalism. Emotionalism that leads to suicide because it is undisciplined. Werther is so much into himself, if you like, that he sees nothing else. And in the end, he thinks he's a misunderstood genius, this great romantic metaphor of the misunderstood genius, which is, of course, a big of narcissism, so much into himself, that in the end, he cannot take refuge from his broken heart, so to speak, in the community. He cannot take refuge anywhere for his broken heart. Not even in the end in nature. He has to commit suicide. He has to commit suicide. And in a way, it is a metaphor of sinful man and innocent woman. Charlotte, after all, is a kind of virginal creature. And the children, we shall come to the metaphor of the children. All this sets the tune of the future. Innocent Charlotte, innocent children, poor Werther. Werther, who in a sense typifies the dangers that John Wesley was afraid of. The danger that John Wesley was afraid of lack of discipline. And therefore, in the end, lack of hope, lack of community. And nothing remains for you but suicide. You have again the same rhythm. You can say nothing remained for Nietzsche either but madness. It's quite true. You can't be a Nietzschean. If you are a Nietzschean in a similar way, there's nothing else for you but suicide also, or madness, which is another kind of complete withdrawal, final complete withdrawal from the world. For Nietzsche, well, Werther didn't get mad, he had suicide, but you have this kind of narcissism. So you must look then at the rise of modern manners and morals, and above all, at their stereotyping, as their conformity. For we have something quite extraordinary, unprecedented, that one kind of attitude, behavior, dress takes in all social classes, takes in all countries eventually, becomes so normative that it becomes, in a sense, worldwide. The first manners and morals that become worldwide. And that in a way become detached from the pietistic root. Detached from the pietistic root. That you have the first worldwide. You have these ideas as a discipline. And with it, because it is a discipline, you not only have what you have here, no exaggeration, no passions, control. Always control. You have also the strong outward signs of inward grace, the strong line between the normal and abnormal, the strong lines between the outward and the inward, the strong signs of, as I say, outward signs of behavior for inward grace, the strong difference between the normal and the abnormal, sexually speaking, so-called normal and so-called abnormal. Sexually speaking. And you must see this again, all of it, against a background of the rapidly changing times. All of this, and I shall come back to it on Friday, the French Revolution, the cataclysm of the French Revolution, the cataclysm of the greater mobility, the cataclysm of a continent in the grip of industrialization, the continent in the grip of industrialization, and always the reaching out for a kind of community and individuality, which ends, of course, as these things are apt to end, in conformity, in a community not of affinity, but a community enforced, and a conformity, which, as I said, will in the end be destined, of course, to last, for I come back again. The onslaught of respectability has produced us all, has produced our attitudes, and has produced the fact that it's so boring to look at you in lecture because you all look alike. In a certain sense, you know, I exaggerate, of course, but look around you. Okay, we're gone.